This podcast is intended for educational purposes only and is not medical or legal advice. Always follow your local policies, procedures, and protocols when functioning in your respective profession. Additionally, the views expressed by the speakers and owners of this podcast are their own and do not represent the views of their respective employers. Listener discretion is advised.
Alert Medic 1, respond.
Ken, Josh, and Mustafa here. Welcome back to the Alert Medic 1 podcast. Hey, welcome back to the Alert Medic 1 podcast. Today you're going to have myself, Moose, and Aaron from PragMed. We're doing something a little different today. We're going to do a short episode about a case review and maybe roll in some topics from that case near the end. It's a new thing we're trying. Let us know what you think. You can DM us, comments, whatever. We're going to try this out. And today we're going to do a little case that I experienced, or that was from my practice. And we're going to be talking about a topic that has really gained a lot of oomph or power within social media and EMS in general. But we're going to be talking about CPR-induced consciousness. So let's hit it. So a quick background on this. The agency that I work with is primarily an ALS chase system. We have a large amount of BLS units with ALS suppression pieces and chase cars. There are some medic transport units or ALS transport units in the county, but they are greatly outnumbered by the BLS units. Paramedics on every engine, along with some chase cars around the county, and we upgrade, downgrade as needed. So the way this whole incident starts, I wasn't even there. It starts as a chest pain call with an ambulance and an engine. They go and they find a approximately 50-year-old male complaining of chest pain. They found him laying on the couch, and he stated that he was taking a shower when he suddenly felt this chest pain 30 minutes prior. They get to some information from him. He's got just previously diagnosed with hypertension 2 weeks ago, and he's been prescribed some Atenolol. He's stating the pain is substernal and had some numbness in the left arm, but denies any jaw pain. They do what they're supposed to do. They do a great ALS assessment. He's ANO times four. He's got a patent airway. He's speaking in complete sentences with no trouble breathing. His skin is dry, pale, and warm. Pulse is strong and fast. So nothing stands out on the initial assessment other than the patient states of some symptomatic chest pain. First set of vitals. His heart rate's 93. His blood pressure is 196 over 120. Respirations of 18. O2 saturation 99%. And they shoot a 12 lead. Can't see it here, but he has some elevation in V1 and V2, along with some depression in AVL 1, and then some slight elevation in AVR. So do you guys have any questions at this point?
I don't. I was only going to ask a question. It may have no relevance whatsoever, but I was curious. Did you say anything about medications he was prescribed?
I just prescribed Atenolol for that hypertension that was diagnosed 2 weeks prior.
And is he, you can tell me later. I was just going to ask, is he taking it? But
he is compliant.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't have anything.
Okay. So they shoot the 12 lead. It qualifies under our criteria, and they decided to make him a STEMI alert, upgrade the call, and in route, they get a second set of vitals. Heart rate's 89, blood pressure's 212 over 141. Respirations of 18, and O2 saturation 99%. While in route, they transmit the 12 lead to the receiving facility. They're going to a CIC. They get an 18 gauge in the left AC, They gave 324 of aspirin, and they gave 0.4 of nitro sublingual two times. So as they're driving down the road, so the paramedic's in the back. He's got one other person. He's got the aide from the ambulance, and then the driver's up front driving. They're going priority one, lights and sirens, down to the hospital. And at about 15 minutes into the transport, the patient says, "I feel like I'm going to pass out." And then he goes unconscious, becomes cyanotic from the mid-chest up to the forehead. They check a pulse, and nothing is found. So this is where I come into play. So we just happen to be leaving the station to do some area familiarization, and we see them on the side of the road, and they're waving us down. As we pull up, we can see them performing CPR in the back. So I grab my monitor. We know they already have ALS equipment, so we get over there, find out what's going on. We, in our system, this would constitute two ALS providers being dispatched on the call. So luckily, we fulfill that second ALS role, so we get those two medics there on scene pretty quickly after pulses are lost and CPR has begun. So we get into this cardiac arrest. I get the story from the medic, tells everything I just told you guys, and CPR is being performed. We get pads on, we pause, and we find VFib. We get back on the chest, shock at 200, and then continue with high performance CPR. So in our jurisdiction, we at the time, and still had adopted doing vector change for refractory VFib. So for those that don't know what vector change, take a look at the dual,
double sequential fibrillation.
But the dose VF trial from Canada. Yeah. That's what really pushed this whole vector change thing. And we had decided, since we saw VFib on the first one, we're going to start preparing for a vector shock, because we do that after three refractory episodes of VFib. We did that with coinciding with the placement of the Lucas device, putting that on during breaks in CPR, not stopping CPR to put it on. We're doing this at our rhythm checks. Second rhythm, VFib, shock at 300. Third rhythm, VFib at 360. We gave 1 milligram epi two times, 300 milligrams amiodarone, and we started an LR bolus. So we've hit our third shock, and now we're considering moving to our vector change. Anything from you guys?
Not yet.
I think you guys are doing a solid job now so far.
Okay. So we hit our vector change ones. Now, something to, if you guys are doing vector change, communicate with your crew that you are switching pads. Not this, you know, haphazard, "Hey, did you do it?" No, actually, like, make sure that the pads are switched between shock 3 and 4, so that you don't deliver a fourth traditional placement shock. Okay. So we're going to swap to those new pads. That we're going to have one anterior, one posterior. The anterior pad is going to be your, what would be called your sternum pad. So the one that would be sitting on your patient's left side of the chest, that's going to go on the front. And then the one that's going to go up on the upper right chest is going to go on the back. This is how the electricity is delivered. It needs to be set up in this way. We send our fourth shock, 360 again. Between our fourth and fifth is when things get weird. So as we're still doing high-performance CPR, the EMT that is bagging states to both of us, the both medics, that, "Hey, the patient is swatting at the mask." Okay. That's a little weird. Okay, let's keep on going. Let's see how this goes. Let's see if this persists. For about 10 or 15 seconds, the EMT continues to say, "Yeah, he's still doing it. He's still doing it." So I look at the other medic and say, "Hey, I think we should pause to assess if this is ROSC or CPRIC. This is definitely not something that's covered in protocol or really any hard guidelines on practice on how you do this. But I think this is one of those things where it's important for us to figure out, do we have a patient that we are now actively compressing their chest while they are awake, alert, and oriented, speaking, or do we have a case of induced consciousness? What do you guys think of that practice?
I imagine that it's really hard to differentiate those two, right? Initially, when you're looking at the patient. I guess I'm always curious about what did the rhythm look like? What did Entitle, was there any like changes to any of that? Or is this just you're doing compressions and he's kind of swatting only?
I think at the time his Entitle was in the 20s or 30s. The rhythm on the screen was CPR, because we were at this point before I'm making this decision to halt or not. It's just a CPR rhythm.
Okay.
So we have life packs. Unfortunately, we don't have the ability to have the see-through CPR technology that Zoll uses.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely something to think about, right? Like, what, I guess, let Moose see what he says, and then I just need to think a little bit more. Because right now, I'm still doing CPR, you know what I mean? Like, if it were me, I'm probably going to keep doing CPR. But I'm also ignorant to a lot of this. And so, for me, it's more about hands on the chest, you know, kind of thing, and ensuring that when I do get ROSC, it's not like epi-ROSC, and then it kind of just fizzles out, you know what I mean? But that's just me. I guess there are people probably have more experience with it. Maybe Moose knows, he can talk to it better than me.
No, actually, Josh, I agree with you, man. I if my patient's moving, I'm definitely going to be at least initially checking, because I'm not, I don't know, I feel like CPR induced consciousness is the zebra, not the horse, right? So that's why I would agree with you to at least initially check and go from there.
So that's what we did. And in that period where we pause compressions for about 15 seconds, roughly, he mumbles incoherently. He moves his arm vigorously at the BVM and then actually rips out his peripheral IV. And then within 15 seconds, he becomes flaccid. Check the pulse. No pulse. He's apneic. Okay. Back on the chest. We had the Lucas on at this point, so we were using the Lucas for compressions. And that's at that point we decide that was CPRIC. So for those that, you know, hopefully you've heard about this, but those that haven't, there is no really great definition of CPRIC right now. But the going interpretation of it is purposeful movement that happens during compressions and either ceases with cessation of compressions or within 10 to 15 seconds of cessation of compressions. Why the 10 to 15 seconds? 10 to 15 seconds because that's about how long it takes for that blood to stop flowing through the body and for that brain to be not perfused anymore. That's why we limit our pauses to less than 10 seconds, because there's this magic number of 10 seconds that's how long it takes to stop.
Mm-hmm.
So cessation within 10 to 15 seconds, we're going to be thinking CPRIC. Aaron, you said something?
No, I was agreeing with everything. I was just kind of mumbling along.
We're going to say this is CPRIC. In my state, in Maryland, we are able to give ketamine at this point. This is one of our indications for ketamine. And so I then get the IO access because he has ripped out his line. We don't have access anymore, so we need to get IO. We did a humeral head. And that's what I prefer. That's what most people I work with prefer. I think it's great. We can talk about it afterwards, since that's been a debate a little bit the other day. And then we gave ketamine 1 mg/kg for CPRIC. And so this is going to sedate them to a point where we're able to still do what we're supposed to do, possibly still get that airway established, but also do some neuroprotectiveness of the ketamine. We're going to use that to kind of calm them down so we don't have them thrashing about and making things worse. By the way, like I said, he went back into arrest. So our fifth shock and our fifth rhythm check is VFib. And we do another vector change shock at 360, and we converted them. We convert to a bradycardic wide rhythm. It was at a rate of about 40. We had not established an advanced airway by this point. Okay, so to give everyone a thought about this, so we're five shocks in. We are at least 10 minutes into our rest. And we have not intubated yet. You don't have to intubate in the beginning of your arrest. I, Josh, say you should the intubation should probably be one of the last ALS interventions you do on an arrest, unless it's a drowning, it's a high suspicion of a respiratory-induced cardiac arrest, or it's a pediatric. Those are like kind of your big three, I think, that you really need to get that tube early than late. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, I'm all about waiting for the tube, unless, like you said, it's respiratory driven. Especially with VFib and VTAC, I'm thinking, I just want a shock and different, get all this going first. Now, if it was PEA and we're thinking this maybe earlier, but yeah, I'm waiting until I can get everything I need to get this patient alive again before I tube them. I think a tube just becomes more of it's something people think they have to do. It goes back to this whole just because you can doesn't mean you should kind of idea. It doesn't mean you have to yet. I mean, if you're bagging and you've got good compliance, why are you fucking around at that point? Just focus on what you need to focus on. That's my personal take. Everybody has their own thing.
Yeah, I agree, I think, for the most part with you guys. The caveat I have is I think we think that we bag better than we actually do.
It's a good point.
So if I can, I can almost guarantee that what most of us see when we are seeing single provider bagging is actually crap bagging. So as long as we have the proper feedback devices telling us we're bagging appropriately and not just someone saying, hey, yeah, if there's great compliance, then yeah, sure. But then that's also me keeping an eye on that person to make sure that they're either not overventilating, underventilating, and not like just getting distracted and like kind of moseying, But yeah, apart from that, I agree with you guys.
Yeah. And for those, if you're not currently doing it, a good idea to see your, bag basically, if you're bagging well and you have a good seal, put an inline capnography device on your BVM. The numbers may be a little skewed, but your waveform, we're looking for waveform here. That's going to tell you if you have a good seal or not. If you're seeing good boxes, good seal. If you're seeing really just wavy waveform on it and not consistent boxes or peak and falls, that might indicate that you don't have a good seal on your BVM. So that's something you can kind of coach your BVM person through. So just an idea. Yeah. So yeah, we rossed him into a bradycardic rhythm. It was wide QRS. In our agency, we try and do about a 10 or 15 minute, I don't want to say pause, but we have a post-ROSC package that we want to do over the course of about 10 to 15 minutes. We don't want to rush it. This involves extrication or egress from the wherever we found the patient. This one was already in the back of an ambulance. Don't have to worry about egress. What do we do have to worry about? Possible 12 lead, but we don't do that because we're going to pace. We have a patient that's bradycardic in a wide rhythm. We're going to pace. We already knew they use a STEMI. Then we advance our secure our advanced airway. We have the time So we have the patient sedated with ketamine. We go ahead and pass that tube. That was a good tube. And then good ventilations via that tube the whole way to the hospital. Some things with the pacing, leads were popping off. So it was losing capture and also pausing our pacing when those leads would pop off for those, you know, remember, put your four lead on, you have to pace, especially, I don't know about Zoll or Phillips. So I know LifeVac will not let you pace if you don't have a four lead on.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had some issues with that, but we constantly got capture back, both mechanical and electrical. But about 5-6 minutes out from the hospital, we lost capture completely. He re-arrested, and he re-arrested into PEA. So we restarted the Lucas. We were bagging. And then I believe we did at least one or two more epis. Any thoughts from you guys on the EMS care?
I have one big question that it could be just pure ignorance, but what's the dosage of the ketamine and I get the CPR and induced consciousness, but I was under the impression, and I could be way off, that ketamine is kind of not necessarily contraindicated, but you should be thinking about it when you have like an MI, you know, cardiovascular stuff. Does that not have any, like, the dosage, is it a low dosage, is it a high dosage, like, what's the what are you giving for that sedation?
Say it's in our realm of dosing, at least in Maryland, it's a medium range dose.
Okay.
So your pain doses are going to be super small. Max of 20 milligrams you're giving. I think the two that I've done, last one I did, I think I gave 12 milligrams. So like a super low number for a pain med that we're used to. Like we're used to, fentanyl, 1 mg/kg. Mm-hmm. And you're given over at least 50 on all your patients. And then your other end of the spectrum, your dissociation for your severe agitation patients, you're looking at high, high numbers, you know, giving a max of 400. You know, so this one, 1 mg/kg, I want to say this guy was, I think we shot him at like 100 kilograms. So he got 100 milligrams of ketamine. And we carry two vials, one high concentration and one low concentration for this purpose. So it makes it easier for calculations and not having a med error.
Okay.
Yeah, Aaron, just to summarize I'm just going to read from the protocol. So for adults, for pain management, 0.2 mg/kg, milligrams per kilo, with a max single dose of 20 milligrams. But the an interesting thing in the protocol that we have is that's the IV dose, right? So for the intranasal or intramuscular dose, it's 0.5 milligrams per kilo. Remember, you know, for our listeners, as always, there's generally a 1 cc max for each nair. So that's where potentially you go to a higher dose than that 20 milligrams, but you're limited by the amount of fluid you can deliver. So I had a dislocated knee that I gave ketamine to a few months ago, and because of the concentration that I had on hand, I was limited to 20 milligrams because of the concentration that I had. So that's that. For severe agitation, the IV dose is 1 milligram per kilo with a max of 200 milligrams. Maximum single dose of 100 milligrams, maximal total dose of IVIO is 200 milligrams. And then IM, it's 4 milligrams per kilo for a max of 400. And then for the, we don't necessarily need to go through ventilatory bucking or anything, but for CPR-induced awareness, for obviously the topic of today, it's 1 milligram per kilo. Just one dose, repeated doses require consultation, but there's no max dose, interestingly. So,
no max dose. Cool. I was just curious. It's not here yet. I mean, I haven't seen it yet, and I was curious more about the dosing than anything, and then obviously the potential for contraindications. But I think at that point, when you have somebody who's dead and you're trying to save them, like, is that really a big deal? Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to re-kill them. I'm not trying to be like an ass wipe here. I'm just saying, like, at that point, you're just giving it so that they're not suffering, right?
Correct.
Okay.
So that they're not trying to inhibit their own resuscitation.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure there's going to be at least a handful of listeners that this is not a protocol you have. This is definitely starting to gain some traction around the U.S. And this was even, I remember when Maryland put it in, I was like, really? Wow, this is a thing, you know? So it's becoming more of a thing around. And that could be a whole nother talk, but I think anecdotally, it's because we're getting a lot better at CPR.
Probably.
Just saying. Also, Mike would love to be here and hear this. Because we're using mechanical CPR devices, we are getting consistent compressions the entire rest. So, Moose, anything?
No, man. I think that was very, you know, I think it's a solid explanation. I mean, I've had one of these that we've talked about where it wasn't nearly as obvious. The patient was, and I was not the primary paramedic on call, but the patient was really just groaning and like kind of doing this weird arm thing where it was like, you know, almost like if he had more energy or if they had more energy, then they would have tried to pull the tube out. But, it was pretty surreal, be honest with you, to witness that. And I was like, oh, okay, this is what I'm saying. I think I texted you immediately after that, that call, just to be like, oh, hey, I finally saw one. And we did the same thing. You know, we dosed at 1 milligram per kilo, maxed it at 100. And gave it that way intravenously, or technically I think I gave it through the IO, but we did not have a positive outcome on that patient, but it's very surreal to see. And I think we're kind of on the early end of implementation in our state compared to other places. I'm very interested in something like this is so hard to investigate, right? I'd be, as anything else, I'd be very interested in what the outcomes are. And again, I fully, for the investigators out there, I fully acknowledge the difficulty of this kind of investigation. But to Aaron's point, I really hope we're not inadvertently harming people, you know. And I would be, if we could plan out some sort of interesting case control where in these scenarios, as and I cannot imagine an IRB approving a, on an ethical basis, someone that if we believe they had a CPR-induced consciousness and we did not treat them. But from a purely investigative standpoint, it'd be an interesting investigation to look at a case control series that looks at giving ketamine versus not giving ketamine for patients that have CPR-induced consciousness, just to see, and even as I say that, the ridiculousness and the obvious confounders are kind of bugging me, but I don't know. I just want to make sure that we're being safe in what we're doing, you know?
I think we are. There was some, I don't think we ever had this as an indication for Versed, but there are places that had this and Versed was the indication or was the med given. And I think when we're looking at between the sedatives that we do carry, ketamine is going to be the safer option in these patients because we have a patient that is gone through the ultimate shock state of cardiac arrest. They are likely hypotensive in some way coming out of the arrest. They've got a weakened cardiovascular system because of what's happened. Likely a cardiovascular event is what caused it. And we don't want to drop that blood pressure with Versed and or another type of benzodiazepine or something that has a greater vasodilatory effect than ketamine.
So my biggest question for people first started talking about this, it may have been a while ago, but social media picked up, and I think Lindsay does. She talks about it a lot on her.
So does Emergency Resilience.
Yeah, I don't follow her, but but I do follow Lindsay. And she does it a lot too. The one thing that I've always pushed back on it and Moose kind of touched on it is the medication. And so one of the questions I had is because people were really up my ass when I pushed back against CPR-induced consciousness. Now, it wasn't that I was saying don't do anything. It's not real. My thought was, what are you giving as a sedative? Because for me, I definitely know Versed causes problems in patients who aren't dead, you know what I mean? And now we're going to give it to somebody who is. So I wonder, like, is it going to be strictly ketamine, or like you said, are these departments kind of trying to figure out what is best for the patient, or do we not know at all yet?
I would say ketamine is our best option right now, okay. Outside of doing some kind of RSI type cocktail. It is a great sedative that has
pain. Yeah,
pain control, but also we don't have the vasoactive components of it as bad. Yes, can it drop blood pressure? Yes, because it raise blood pressure. Yes, but no profound on either end of that.
And it's probably no worse than epi, right? Neurologically, I mean.
Well, that's the other thing is that they are finding it has neuroprotective capabilities. So it actually does help preserve some of that brain function after someone's been in this hypoxic state. Luckily, with this patient, they did walk out of the hospital.
That's good.
Yeah, they were in the hospital for 2 weeks. They went home. They got a cath. The patient, he tried to extubate himself in the ER. The guy received CPR for almost an hour, but it was consistent CPR. It was good compressions, proper depth, proper rate, both manual and by Lucas. And it kept that brain perfused. And I'd like to believe that the ketamine helped in that brain perfusion and brain protection. And I don't have any studies in front of me, but I do know there is a lot of talk about being neuroprotective.
Actually, I do have some of those studies. So just pulling up everything. So interestingly, first, though, there is a trial going on right now called the KidCat study being sponsored by Fraser. Why am I blanking on where Fraser is? But Fraser Health. But they are doing, and I'm just going to read the summary. A recent evidence suggests ketamine may attenuate harmful cellular cascades taking place after brain injury that result in permanent damage. The investigators are interested in researching the application of this in the setting of cardiac arrest. Following cardiac arrest, the brain is deprived of oxygen for a period of time, leading to the imitation of these harmful cellular processes. The investigators hypothesize that patients who receive ketamine as part of their standard sedation procedures during cardiac arrest treatment have better neurological functioning compared to those who do not. The disease they're investigating here is specifically out of hospital cardiac arrest, and that's on the specific clinicaltrials.gov website, which I can send to you, Josh. There was a recent paper that ketamine. Josh, you got my brain going here. I'm trying to find it right now. That talks about the specific effects of ketamine on the cardiovascular function, but critically, what you mentioned is. We are dealing with patients in the ultimate shocky state, right? So that is certainly relevant to discuss here. And then I also wanted to bring up, my gut tells me that I am not sure what the answer is, right? To if this is the safest drug or not, or if there is a net benefit or a net harm. Because as I was reviewing some literature, I'm seeing like random case studies, like the one I just found from March 2024 in the American Journal of Emergency Medicine about, it's a random article that says, ketamine's love story with the heart, a Takotsubo twist, where it's a case report of ketamine inducing Takotsubo cardiomyopathy after sedation, right? So I feel like there's so many one-offs out there that... I don't know. I would have to do a better literature review before I developed an opinion on it. And also, I don't know what I don't know. I don't know if there are other agents out there that could be potentially useful in the hospital setting that our pharmacy colleagues and our physician colleagues may know about that we don't. A review that I found from 2022 in the what journal is this? The use of ketamine as a neuroprotective agent following cardiac arrest, a scoping review, obviously is not meant for patients in cardiac arrest, but after cardiac arrest. And it was a, let's see here. Basically, what they found is the current state of the literature describes the mechanism of action of ketamine as a neuroprotective agent through its action as an NMDA antagonist. There is evidence of its efficacy as a neuroprotective agent in preclinical models of cardiac arrest. Current published clinical work support the use of ketamine ameliorating neurological outcomes and other conditions. The current state of the literature is reflective of the notion that the use of ketamine following cardiac arrest may result in improved neurological outcomes, but future research direction should focus on the use of ketamine as a possible clinical intervention following cardiac arrest. So I think the jury's truly out there is what I'm saying. And I don't know. I'm not confident to make a decision one way or the other right now, just because I don't know what I don't know, and I haven't done my research.
I have a question, if you don't. Are we seeing CPR-induced consciousness more often in a specific rhythm? Like, is this a VFib, VTech shockable thing, or are these PEA systoles? Like, where are they seeing the most occurrence or the most incidence of it?
I think this is anecdotal.
That's fine.
For me, at least. The people I've heard that talked about seeing it, it's always been in a VFib, VTAC. A lot of witness arrests. And there is almost always and then associated ROSC involved as well. Positive neuro outcomes, mixed bag. But it's almost like your fresh arrest in a VFib, VTAC when the heart is most vulnerable for this. And then, you know, throw in things like high performance CPR, pit crew mechanic or pit crew systems and Lucas devices or auto pulses. And like, it's all about perfusing the brain. And if you have a viable heart, which we all say the most viable is the VTAC and VFib patient.
Mm-hmm.
Then yeah. I mean, Moose, you got something, anything?
No, I was going to say if either of you have any sources, because I had not found a good, analysis of CPR induced patients. And, what I did find was
there's one. What's it called? What's the big one called? Awake.
I don't know.
Isn't it the Awake? Awake trial or something?
I can look it up. I'm not sure.
A big one. It's one of the ones that usually gets referenced when people are trying to talk about it on social media. I know I looked it up because I was more concerned. I mean, I'm sure that it works, but I was more concerned about what sedatives people were using. And at that point, my concern was, we have so many people in the industry who know shit and they think they know everything, but they don't. And I fear, and it's a silly fear, but it's a training issue, is you put some of these medics into these situations and they're just going to start dropping patients like flies. I mean, they're already dead, but you're going to give people pushing, 10 milligrams of Versed on a patient with no pressure. That's just a quick kill.
What I can talk about is so they did who was this resuscitation did in 2022 did a scoping analysis of all the pre-hospital guidelines for CPR induced consciousness. This was by Howard et al. And they found that it was very interesting what they found. And let me just briefly read the findings. Of the 23 pre-hospital guidelines available, we identified 20 different ways of treating CPR-induced consciousness. Midazolam was the most frequently used drug to treat CPR-induced consciousness at 14 of the 23, or 61%, followed by ketamine, which was 11 out of the 23 protocols, and fentanyl, which was 9 of the 23 protocols, or 39%. So, and then from a dosing perspective, let's see here. Hold on. Let me bring that up real quick. I literally just had it up. Ketamine, the lowest bolus ketamine dose was 10 milligrams and the largest was a 200 milligram intravenous dose. Waste-based dosage calculations were used in 6 of the guidelines. No maximum dose of ketamine was stated in 5 of the guidelines. And then one guideline used the weight-based calculation of 1.5 milligrams per kilo. For fentanyl, like I said, 9 of the 23 guidelines, the lowest bolus dose used was 25 micrograms IV, and the largest was 100 micrograms intravenously. Weight-based dosage calculations were used in 2 of the guidelines. No maximum fentanyl dose was stated in 6 of the guidelines, and then one had a weight-based dose of 4 milligrams per kilo. And then finally for Versed, midazolam was the lowest IV bolus dose used to treat was 1 milligram intravenously, and the largest was 2.5 milligrams intravenously, which seems super low, right? Like Josh had mentioned, the lowest IM dose was 2 milligrams, while the highest was 10. Weight-based dosage calculations were used in one of the guidelines. No maximum doses were stated in five of the guidelines, which is kind of scary. The rest of the guidelines had the highest maximum dose at 30 milligrams intravenously, whilst the lowest dose was 1 milligram intravenously. Yeah, so it's kind of in the air, kind of alluding to what you were talking about, Aaron, right? Where the, I don't know.
There's no standard is basically what my concern has been is I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't be doing anything for these patients. What I'm saying is we should be doing what's best. And it sounds to me like what Josh is saying is that ketamine at this point seems like the best all around medication, considering its properties and its dosage range. You know, you really can't dick around with Versed too much. You pretty much have a range of, like you said, one to whatever. But nobody's really going to push that. Ketamine just seems more appropriate. I would still like to see more actual, like you said, some sort of case control or something to see what these doses are doing or what doses proven to be also one, not just safe, but efficacious.
Yeah, I think we're going to here in the near future because it is becoming a thing. Before it was like, it truly was like one-offs. And you know, the study you just sent about that they studied the UK paramedics, most of them didn't know what was going on until it happened because they didn't have the education. And I know.
How many codes are you on where somebody's like, I think they're breathing or I think they're moved? Or, and you kind of look over and you're like, what? No, they're good. And you just go back to it.
Yeah.
But yeah, the point is you make a really good point about CPR induced cousins. Why are we seeing it? We can all make a bunch of generalizations here, but I think CPR is getting better. And with the advent, and this takes a lot for me to say this, of the Lucas and Autopulse, they are helping pave the way for, you know, better overall compressions and potentially better outcomes and neurological outcomes for patients that have, needed CPR. So,
yeah. And I would wholeheartedly agree with that. I mean, this positive outcome of this whole call is because of the basics of CPR, good compressions and early appropriate defibrillation. Everything else outside of that was just gravy. It was extra stuff.
So you guys didn't push bicarb?
No, we did not.
Okay. Just asking.
But, you know, it's all about those basics. And something I said, I think I commented on emergency resilience post about it once. Or it was a post about CPRIC. And someone was scared when they saw it happen. Mm-hmm. And that how they felt about it later, and that it was off-putting. And what I want to say to our audience is, if you do see this is a sign that you're doing things right. Don't be scared of this. If you have the protocols to treat it, do so, but don't be scared of it. Don't think you're doing something wrong. This is you doing the right things, because they can't have this happen if they don't have perfusion to the brain. And even if it is in the end a ROSC, once again, that's a win for you. That is you doing the right thing because you did the compressions correctly. If you defibrillate, you defibrillate early and appropriately, and then you did everything else swimmingly as well. So this is all good things. This is not you inducing harm to the patient. This is not something that should be looked at as faux pas. This is good.
Yep. Can I ask you a question about a patient I had once?
Sure.
So this was a trauma patient. It was a GSW to the belly. When I arrived on scene, the fire was already there performing CPR. There was definitely blood in his belly. You could see the hole with blood coming out. We made the decision at this point just to load him up. There was no blood at this time. You know, none of that stuff really existed. It was basically normal saline and diesel or gas. I think we had gas truck. But point is, was to get in the hospital. The only thing that we could do en route, because it was a belly, you know, I wasn't going to stop anything, Reboa, but I did CPR all the way in. So it was probably 5.5 minutes into the hospital, and I just did compressions. When we pulled in, he sat up, like he actually lifted up off the cot, kind of like he was laying, and then his front came up, like torso. and then it went back down, obviously, because we stopped doing compressions. Do you think that that could have been CPR-induced consciousness, or do you just think that that was, like, his last... He didn't make it.
A waking the dead moment?
Yeah.
It definitely sounds like it could have been. And I would say it would be even rarer in that instance because it's a traumatic arrest.
Yeah.
But, I mean, let's be honest. Dead people don't just raise up.
Right, right. That's what I was saying. It at the time, this is 11 years ago, but it felt very like I did the right thing, but it never dawned on me that it was CPR-induced consciousness. It wasn't something I thought about. I thought it was just like, I don't know, zombie apocalypse at that point.
So was there like activity? Then he like just cranked shot up and then shot back?
Yeah, basically he was dead, right? Like he was just like, we were bringing a shooting in. And it was a shooting 5 minutes outside of the hospital. When I got there, he looked like he had been there for days. Like he was completely colorless. His shoes were off. They had stolen his shoes. And we got him into the truck. We were using Fire's little AED because it was the fastest thing that we could do to get him here. But yeah, nothing. He had nothing. He wasn't moving. He was clenched. We were planning to nasally intubate, if that tells you anything. And we pulled into the bay. I still continued to do compressions. The doors opened. So I was on the compression side, not the normal medic bench, but I was on the other side doing compressions. They opened the doors and I could see people coming to help us pull him out of the truck. And right when they opened the doors, he sat up, kind of just faced forward and then laid right back down.
That kind of reminds me of I don't know if Josh already said the joke or not, but like the Lazarus effect, right? Isn't that them literally just shooting back up because of a temporary like reoxygenation, and then like just because of the lift, they lose that pressure and then they just slam back down? Isn't that what that sounds like?
Somewhat, but Lazarus is actually usually like nothing's been done for like 10 or 15 minutes, like you call the code and like 15 minutes later they get a pulse back.
What I'm saying though, not necessarily the Lazarus effect, but the mechanism and the physiology behind what could have occurred, that could occur then, is kind of what you're describing, Aaron, where this guy was like obviously hypoperfused due to like, you know, his blood wasn't where it needed to be, but then because of what you did, there was like some temporary, you know, return for a split second that whatever basal animalistic brainstem stuff kicked back on, he like lifted up and then went right back down. I don't know.
Yeah, it didn't seem like CPR induced consciousness, and it definitely felt strange. But you know, it just, now that everybody's talking about it, I've been thinking back through all of the patients who kind of sat up or moved, and I'm trying to decide whether or not they were an induced, you know, from CPR. But it doesn't make a lot of sense, right, with a trauma patient, because the blood is literally like in my glove. It's not like I'm really doing a great job of pushing. I was just doing CPR because that's what you're supposed to do, kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But anyway, thank you.
Okay.
For letting me ask.
Well, that basically concludes it for the case. I'm not going to go into the whole hospital care. Like I said, this guy did walk out of the hospital and is living a healthy life now. Good. He's still alive. So yeah,
you should follow up with the patient to see if he remembers anything.
I'll tell you about something in a second when we're offline.
You should have him on the show.
That might be. We'll see. But so we're at like 48 minutes. Do we want to go into IOs, or do you just want to call it here?
I prefer to call it. I gotta do some other crap. But
yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Jack just got brought down here because Jasmine has to run out. So
go.
But we'll go ahead. I'll take us out. Actually, Moose, do you want to take us out?
Absolutely.
Just because I've got Jack in the background.
You go handle Jack, buddy.
But I'll be here. He's just making sounds.
Oh, no, you're fine. You're fine. Hey, Aaron, thank you so much for joining, man. This was pretty cool. And for our listeners out there, thank you so much for your continued support and your continued listenership, your continued engagement on social media. Wherever you're listening from, as Josh would eloquently put it, Good morning, good evening, or good night. Thank you for listening to the Alert Medic One podcast.